Welcome to the show, everyone. We're here for episode 2 of All Movie Talk. We have a great show lined up for you, starting with a top 6 list that is all about the bad guys, but a different kind of bad guy than the usual sneering evil type, and you'll see what we mean when we get there. Also, another trivia question that we'll try to stump Steven and you guys with, and then Steven will talk a bit about the history of black and white and color cinematography in the movies. Following that, we'll talk about a great, terrible movie. Wrapping things up, we'll have a film-style spotlight on Italian neorealism, and if that doesn't sound exciting, well, I think you maybe want to stick around anyway, because it kind of is. I am Sam Stoddard.
And I am Kaiser Soze. Stephen Keller.
Yeah, I was confused because you said a different name.
Well, I'm tricky that way.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully by the time we get around to the top 6 list, you won't be confused, because that's coming right up, isn't it? Well, we come to another of our weekly segments, and this one is our top 6 about some particular strange topic. And we don't do top 5. Why is that, Sam?
Because it's not enough.
That's right. We got to go one better. So this week, we're going to look at movie villains. But we're not going to do the usual, you know, your favorite movie villains. We're going to do the movie villains that are in some way sympathetic, that are a little more interesting. They're not just pure evil, no psychotic killers who just kill for the fun of it. So let's jump in here. My number 6 is not a particular character, but rather the strangers, the villains from Dark City, the 1998 great sci-fi thriller. The strangers are an alien race who are screwing around with humans, but it's sort of an attempt to bind the human soul. The strangers are dying, and they don't really have any sense of good or evil, and I think that's one of the things that makes them interesting. I generally feel sorry for them. There's one of the scenes at the end where one of the last of these aliens is talking to the hero, and he's saying, you know, I'm dying. I wish I could understand what you feel. And it's kind of sad in a way that these guys who are really doing terrible things to these people are, you know, also not really meaning to be bad.
Yeah, it's a great film and a lot to think about in that one. My number 6 was character of Carl, Billy Bob Thornton's character from Sling Blade. Now, here's a guy who, at the age of 12, killed his mother and her lover. And, you know, most people wouldn't take the time to get to know and empathize with somebody like that. But this movie does. It doesn't excuse or even forgive those crimes, but it paints a really compelling character portrait and helps us to see where somebody like this is coming from in life and understand that even in the extremes, people aren't just all good or all bad.
Now, my number 5 pick is Tom Ripley from a series of movies based on the Patricia Highsmith novels about the character. He was played by Alain Delon in the 1960 French film Purple Noon, by Matt Damon in the 1999 film The Talented Mr. Ripley. John Malkovich played him recently in a version of Ripley's Game, and I think the character Tom Ripley is fascinating and works well on film because he's sort of a killer, but I don't know if we necessarily sympathize with him so much as we kind of like him because he seems elegant and refined and smart, and he's just a deeply disturbed person. You know, when he murders one of the first people he murders in the Talented Mr. Ripley or Purple Noon, it's a guy that he's sort of in love with, and it's a very, very strange villain.
My number 5, actually, Steven, would you like some fried bananas?
Uh-huh.
Okay. My number 5 is the character of Frank Chambers from The Postman Always Rings Twice. Now, actually, just about any film noir anti-hero could fit this list because that's what noir is. Everybody is a bad guy. And, of course, some are sympathetic, some are not. This guy is just sort of an innocent bystander, really. He stops at a gas station and meets a femme fatale type of character there, and they wind up committing a murder together. This is a recurring theme in a lot of noir. It shows up in Double Indemnity and even on into neo-noir with Body Heat. But this is the one I think I sympathize with the most, so this is the one I chose for this list.
Yeah, great pick. I was conflicted. I ran through a lot of noir in my head, and I couldn't ever decide if most of these people were villains or not, so I kind of just stayed away from it. A lot of mine, actually, I think, came from sci-fi, which I find interesting, because I think in science fiction, often we're dealing with characters who aren't human, and writers seem to be willing to give them a little more depth, strangely, than human villains. Which leads me to my number 4, who is the character Roy Batty from Blade Runner, the 82 Ridley Scott film. The character is played by Rutger Hauer, and he's one of the last of these replicant androids that the Harrison Ford character is tracking down and killing. You know, the androids are kind of psychotic, but it's not entirely their fault. They were made that way. And at the end of the movie, Batty actually saves the Harrison Ford character's life, and so sort of dies because they have this lifespan that the company built them to only last for 4 years, and he has these fake memories, but they don't really do much for him, and he has that sort of, you know, famous quotation about the things that he's seen, these sights that no humans will ever see, and as he's dying, you know, these memories are all going to be lost, these moments, like, washed away like tears in the rain. And I think it's really compelling and a really good film about what it means to be human, that in some way these overtly robotic characters are more human than some of the other humans in the movie.
That's an interesting take on that. That actually reminds me of my number two, which we'll get to later, so let's remember that for then. Mm. But my number four is HAL 9000 in 2001, A Space Odyssey. I picked this one because it presents such an interesting example of how the movies can manipulate our emotions and spur us to make flawed moral judgments. Because HAL is not actually evil. He behaves evilly, but he's a computer. He's just doing what he was programmed to do. And yet, the movie has such an impact that here he comes off as one of the coldest, cruelest, most ruthless villains of all time.
Mm. Yeah, well, absolutely. HAL is actually one of my picks a little later on. My number third villain is another science fiction character. It's Darth Vader, Anakin Skywalker, who I think really gets fleshed out. One of the good things you can say about the new prequels is I think they do a pretty decent job of showing the transformation of Anakin into Darth Vader. And certainly at the end of Return of the Jedi, when Vader is redeemed and his mask takes off and he dies, I think we feel a lot of sympathy for a guy who, in his first movie appearance, you know, in the first Star Wars film, just a dark, menacing figure of pure evil. I think we get a good sense of a guy who, at one point in time, was trying to do the right thing and just let power run away with him.
Yeah, but it's interesting you mentioned the prequels. I think I felt more sympathy for him just having seen parts 4, 5, and 6.
Really?
Yeah, because I think the prequels kind of cut away in the wrong places when they talk about his transformation. In episode 2, when he's slaughtering the village of the sand people, they cut away and don't really show what his psychological state of mind was throughout that process. And then in episode 3, it was a great scene, but kind of an abrupt transition of loyalties, I thought.
Well, I'm not going to try and defend that Star Wars is particularly good at handling subtle psychological things, but I mean, those are fair criticisms, but I still think that getting some sense of his backstory. And I like the sand people scene. I think it's one of the best scenes from the
but
new
it wasn't
trilogy.
There.
Well, it's there as much as you can get in a PG movie.
Okay. Fair enough. My number three is the character of Michael Corleone from the Godfather trilogy. He is evil, but he's also motivated by a lot of things we can identify with. And he has a code of honor that he strives to cling to, warped though it may be. But the movies show how unworkable his value system really is when the code ultimately forces him to betray those things that he values. In all three films, he wrestles with a desire to go legit and to leave crime behind, but it just doesn't work out for him. And I think part of that is because of the world around him kind of expecting him to be a villainous character, really. And also partly because I don't think he wants to do it for the right reasons. I don't think it's in him to be anything other than the villain he knows how to be.
I think that's an interesting point. I thought about that. I also thought about the character from Goodfellas. There's that great part in Goodfellas where the character talks about how, you know, I don't want to be a regular person. I want to be somebody special and important. Yeah. And I think that's a key component to the Corleone character. And yeah, definitely a great choice. And I think it's interesting that he does sort of get into crime in the first movie after he's kind of escaped it. He does sort of get back into it to help save his family.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, my number two pick, we've already mentioned, is HAL 9000 from 2001, A Space Odyssey. And yeah, I think what you were saying earlier is worth noting. In fact, what's interesting is HAL doesn't start behaving psychotically until they try and disconnect him. He reads their lips when they're in the pods talking about how they're going to plan to disconnect him, and at that point he starts going kind of haywire. I mean, he had some earlier problems, making some mistakes, which, you know, the HAL 9000 computers weren't supposed to, but he's not killing anyone, and so he's actually acting in self-defense in a way. And I think that certainly he seems cold and chilling just because he has no emotions, but that final scene with HAL where he's just being disconnected by Dave as Dave pulls out all his memory cards and HAL slowly reverts and makes his final plea to not be killed is really, really kind of sad.
Yeah, yeah. Very powerful scene. My number two pick, I kind of cheated on this one because I had two characters that sort of fulfilled the same kind of role, but I couldn't choose between them, so I didn't. They are the characters of King Kong from King Kong. either the 1933 or the 2005 version.
You're not going to take the 70s version?
No, we'll skip right by the 70s version. And the other one is the Frankenstein monster from the film Frankenstein. Now, these two characters are not the cruel, raging beasts of a lot of monster movies, Godzilla and so forth. They're just poor creatures, innocent bystanders that people have made villains out of. Everyone around them sort of forces them into that role of a villain. In Frankenstein, there's this great scene that was cut from the original release but was restored later. The monster comes across a girl throwing flower petals into the water, and he thinks that that's a pretty nice thing. So he starts doing that too. And then he runs out of petals, and you see him looking down at his hands, like, what am I going to do now? He's confused and doesn't really know, so he picks up the little girl and throws her in. And then he's just horrified at the consequences. He's not evil. He's just dumb as a brick. he was playing the fun game of throwing pretty things into the water, and it went bad, and he doesn't really understand why. But, of course, everybody assumes that he's just this evil, raging beast that has to be destroyed, and pretty much King Kong's story is much the same.
Certainly, and that's, I think, our sort of recurring theme here is that things that are not human are just misunderstood by humans in the movies and then made to be villains when maybe they really aren't villains at all.
Yeah.
And I thought about picking Kong for my list, but I feared you'd get him, so I didn't have to. So my number one, perhaps an interesting choice, kind of came to me, and the more I thought about it, the more I liked it. Norma Desmond, played by Gloria Swanson in Billy Wilder's 1950 film Sunset Boulevard, one of the classic sort of noir films. And Desmond is an aging silent star who she meets up with this writer who's a young writer who's in debt, and he kind of takes advantage of her. She's going crazy living in this old house all alone with her butler, her former director, played by Eric Stroheim, and she's sort of taken advantage of it. And at the end, she's demented and maybe a little psychopathic, but the hero of the movie, he's not been very nice to her, and we feel sorry for her. And it's interesting because this is one of the early movies that's really about the effects of film and the way, particularly, that Hollywood, as in the movie industry, chews up and spits out women. It's interesting, of course, because Gloria Swanson, who plays Desmond, was actually a silent film actress who didn't really find work beyond the transition as she got older and into sound. And you know, the idea that I'm still big, it's the pictures that got small, is something that is going to be repeated by women throughout Hollywood throughout the ages.
But the happy ending for her, her real life story, is that this was her greatest role, really.
Absolutely.
My number one pick is actually the literary villain. It's the character of Fagin, the thief who inhabits the streets of London in Charles Dickens's Oliver Twist. There are a few great performances of this character, like Alec Guinness in the David Lean version. My favorite is Ron Moody's delightful portrayal in the 1968 musical Oliver, directed by Carol Reed, who also did The Third Man. This story has another great villain, Bill Sykes, who really is pure evil, but you get the sense that Fagin would have lived a very different life if he had been given a different hand. In the musical, his deliberations on how he should live his life, to go straight or not, what is he going to do, makes up one of the best songs, and actually says a lot about how trapped he feels in this lifestyle. And I think that thought process is something anybody can relate to, you know, no matter how dissimilar your life may be to that of a thief in the slums of London.
So I think we've had a pretty good diversity here. Let me run over my list again. Number six was The Strangers, the not-so-evil aliens from Dark City. Number five was Tom Ripley, who's been played by a number of actors in a number of films. Number four is Roy Batty from Blade Runner. Number three, Darth Vader from the Star Wars trilogies, I guess. Number two, HAL 9000 from 2001 A Space Odyssey. And number one, Norma Desmond, the aging screen star from Sunset Boulevard.
And to recap my top six list, we have number six, Carl from Sling Blade. Number five, Frank Chambers from The Postman Always Rings Twice. Number four, HAL 9000 from 2001 A Space Odyssey. Number three, Michael Corleone from The Godfather Trilogy. Number two is a tie between King Kong and the Frankenstein Monster. And number one, Fagin from any version of Oliver Twist. And Stephen, how did we get through both of these lists without mentioning Dog Day Afternoon?
That's a good question.
Because, yeah, oh well.
You know, you're always going to have some misses.
So, we come to the part of the show where I ask you a trivia question, and you fumble and try in vain to come up with the answer. What do you think, Stephen?
I think you've accurately described the way this segment works.
Okay. Today's question is, what film stars both Boris Karloff and Jack Nicholson? See, even after seeing them together, it doesn't seem like there should be an answer to this because these two actors are so separated by time in my mind. But
I really hope it's Wolf.
No, there are actually two correct answers, and that is neither one of them. So,
huh?
Any ideas?
Wolf 2, Wolfer?
We'll come back at the end of the show and let you know.
Color in the movies is one of the biggest changes that the movies went through from their early days, probably second only to sound in terms of the way it changed things. And we're going to talk today a little bit about the history of color in the movies. It's actually older than you may realize. Next week, in the next episode, we're going to talk again a little more about color, but we're going to talk about maybe why color is not always such a good thing, and why some people, a lot of film buffs particularly, might even prefer black and white for certain movies. Now, one of the things I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize is that color exists from the very earliest films. Motion pictures sort of came around in the 1890s, around 1895 is when they first started exhibiting sort of short features commercially. And from pretty much that point in time, they had some color. Now, they didn't have color film, of course, but what they would actually do is hand paint every frame in a short film. Now, since obviously the movies back then were maybe 5 minutes at a go, this wasn't that hard, but it's still, I mean, you figure back then there were somewhere around maybe 16 to 20 frames per second. That's a lot of painting you had to do. It's almost like animating. And so this wasn't ever something that was done a whole lot. It was sort of more experimental in the very early days and played around with some of the very short shorts, but it wasn't obviously going to work for major features when you start having movies that are an hour or more, several reels. But one thing that did happen in some of the earlier silent features is what's called tinting, where they take black and white film and actually go ahead and tint an entire reel of the movie by basically putting it in dye. An example that comes to my mind is in Chaplin's The Gold Rush. He uses tinting there to sort of denote different areas and moods. He uses maybe a blue for the outdoor scenes at night, or a warmer kind of sepia tone for indoor scenes. And you don't always see this in silent movies because sometimes it wasn't done always, but also some of the versions that exist on TV or on video may not include the tinting, so it's kind of spotty how much of this has been restored.
Just to jump in, I was going to say they don't use the same process, of course, but actually this technique is still used now and again. I'm thinking of the 2000 film Traffic, where there's three different narratives, and the tint of the frame is
different. Well, yeah, and what they're doing with that, actually, of course, is they're using either filters on the lens or gels on lights to get specific colors of lighting.
Right.
But yeah, exactly the same idea
and sort of the same effect, really. It allows you to distinguish one place or one thread from another.
Exactly. The idea is color, from very early on, was used to convey specific information. Now, in the early 20s in America, something called Technicolor came about. Now, Technicolor was actually a process as well as a company. It was basically a trust that the big studios formed that was going to control pretty much color in America, and they were very rigid about how they let it be used. And kind of interesting, in the early 20s, they developed what's called two-strip Technicolor, and it required special film where they basically had two pieces of black and white film with a prism that would basically take the light from the camera and play it to both pieces of the film. So one would be green, one would be red, and then you actually, to get a color print, you basically had to paste two pieces of film together and then project it. And it didn't give you full color the way that we think of it. It was a more limited spectrum, but it did give you color. And so in 1922, The Toll of the Sea was the first Hollywood feature to be entirely done in color. It was actually done sort of by the Technicolor Trust as a way to demo their technology. And you see in this period of time some of the silent features using color in some scenes. DeMille did it. Cecil B. DeMille, for instance, in his 1923 version of The Ten Commandments, has some scenes in color. Others are in black and white. I think the Parting of the Red Sea, for instance, is one he did in color. And then in 26, there's a very famous movie called The Black Pirate. Douglas Fairbanks was starred in it, and it's an all-color feature using the two-strip Technicolor process. But there are a lot of technical problems with this. It's expensive. It requires special equipment. You got to actually cement these pieces of film together. It's hard to project. It was used not a ton, and maybe, you know, they would use it for certain scenes, but it didn't really
wasn't really a very, very good technical process. So in 32, Technicolor introduced what they call three-strip Technicolor, and this is what we think of when we think of Technicolor movies from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. You're basically, again, once again, using three different strips of film, and when you print them, you end up basically sort of doing what they do with commercial printing, printing a red, yellow, blue, and black. So the three strips are the three colors, red, yellow, and blue, when it's printed, to get brilliant, brilliant colors. Again, this was very expensive, though. It required a special camera. It was not at all sensitive to light. So if you're in low-light situations, very difficult to film. It sort of got its big start in cartoons. Disney, in 32, started doing it. He made some shorts in using the three-strip Technicolor process. And then in 37, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was made in three-strip Technicolor. And it's, of course, at that point in time, the biggest movie ever. Huge smash. And that sort of convinces the industry, wow, okay, this is a good process, and we're going to have to use it. But, again, it's expense, and its limitations means that it's going to be saved. It's not going to be used for every movie. You can think of some of the early Technicolor three-strip movies that we remember, Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz, The Adventures of Robin Hood, those movies from the 30s. And you think of something like Wizard of Oz, where, once again, they're using color to delineate the Oz sequences from the real sequences, which start out in black and white, and then, of course, there's that gorgeous transition to Technicolor. Technicolor has really, really good representation of color, super saturated look, and it's a really great look. When you think of those old movies, and if you've seen them restored, and a lot of them are now available on beautiful DVDs, you know exactly what we're talking about. Now, after World War II, we start to see the introduction of color more and more. Part of this is because, of course, throughout the rest of the world, other countries were developing color technology, especially in Germany. And actually, American companies got some of that German technology as part of the spoils of World War II. And Eastman Kodak used it to help develop what they call the Eastman color process. Now, this was actually a one-strip process, so just one piece of film was actually able to capture color information. It makes it a lot cheaper, and it doesn't require these huge, bulky, special Technicolor cameras. It doesn't, however, give you as good a color representation. Eastman color is not as bright, it's not as bold, it's not as vibrant, but it is a lot cheaper and it's a heck of a lot easier to work with. And so something else happens after the war, and that's the introduction of television. Now, the movie studios sort of freak out about television because, hey, they can show moving pictures at home. Why would you go to the theater? And this sort of leads, in the early 50s, the studios to start doing things like, you know, they introduced 3D, which is a hit for a little while. But some more interesting changes is this brings about the advent of widescreen shooting and shooting anamorphic formats, or think of, say, Cinerama, where they actually use, like, three screens and tricky cameras and stuff. But this actually really, really pushes the industry toward using color in movies, because in the 50s, there wasn't really color TV, and it's not even until the 60s that television has color sort of widespread. So during the 50s, Hollywood really makes the transition to using color, and unfortunately, they largely settle on the Eastman process because it's so much cheaper. It doesn't look as good, and it definitely doesn't preserve as well. A lot of early Eastman color movies have not held up well the way the Technicolor movies have, but we definitely see more of this Eastman color process just because it's so much easier to work with. By the 1960s, color is pretty much the norm. The Apartment in 1960 is the last black and white movie to win Best Picture until Schindler's List in 1993. And so you don't really see a whole lot of black and white after really the end of the 50s. However, we start seeing something interesting happen, and that is the return of black and white. I can't think of a whole lot of examples of black and white movies between, say, especially black and white American movies between 65 and the early 80s, but in 1980, Martin Scorsese makes Raging Bull deliberately in black and white as an artistic choice. And I think that was a pretty big deal. It still is. You don't think of a lot of 80s movies as being in black and white, but that one is, and it's one of the better ones. And you will see in this time period some smaller movies that are done in black and white because it's cheaper. It remains cheaper. And that's something I'm going to touch on in just a second. But what's interesting is during the transition period, say the early 60s, late 50s, where you could go to color, like, you know, any decently budgeted movie was going to be in color, whereas B pictures were going to be black and white. Hitchcock in 1960 chooses to shoot Psycho on the cheap and in black and white because, one, he was worried about, I think, the gore in color. He didn't want to, if he saw blood going down a drain, if it was in color, didn't know if he could sneak that past the censors. But also because I think he deliberately wanted to shoot black and white because you get a more interesting feel. He wanted to make sort of a good B movie, and he certainly succeeded. And it's hard to imagine Psycho in color. I mean, could you imagine if someone tried remaking?
No, not at all. That would be the most foolhardy thing you could
do. Try to shoot Psycho in color.
And why would you remake it anyway?
Fortunately, that's never happened. Now, I think in the late 80s, you start seeing the rise of the independent film. And you start thinking of filmmakers like Spike Lee. His first movie, She's Got to Have It, in 86. It's basically independently financed. He gets the money and he makes this film and sort of bursts on the scene. And this sort of, you know, along with Sex, Lies, and Videotape by Soderbergh, sort of brings up the indie movie scene. And so in the 90s, you start seeing a lot more independent movies that gain traction. I mean, there are obviously always been independent films, but it wasn't... In the 90s, you get the weird phenomenon of independent films being released by major studios, which still is strange to me. Think of Kevin Smith, who made Clerks in 1994 for $17,000 or whatever, shot it in black and white because he didn't have the money for color. And in fact, you know, when he made Clerks 2, he had money and he put it in color because he didn't really want to do it in black and white. But the sort of limitations, I think, of a lot of artists who don't have the money to work in color in the 90s, they do some interesting things with black and white. And so I think there's now, partially because of that, there's this idea that black and white is okay to shoot in if you're trying to make an artistic point. And certainly Spielberg in 93 with Schindler's List definitely proves this. And I remember at that time, it was sort of a big deal that he made a movie in black and white, this major movie in black and white by such a major director. And an interesting thing to mention about Spielberg and Schindler's List is that there is color in the movie a little bit. There's the bookend scenes, I think, are in color. The burning candles that start the movie are in color. And, of course, the little girl in the red coat that he uses sort of as a recurring image in a few scenes to single her out and to sort of get us inside the head of the Schindler character, who starts seeing these people as actual people and reflecting his transformation. Spielberg is very creative visually, and here he's using color within black and white. And that's something that we're going to see as the 90s progress, very, very famously in 1998. Pleasantville, a movie both Sam and I love, uses digital technology. In 93, Spielberg did this all with film. In 1998, Pleasantville, they are able to use computers to throw color in the black and white scenes. And if you don't remember the movie, the whole idea is that these characters are trapped inside a 1950s black and white sitcom, but as they start bringing their values into this world, it becomes color. And it's just gorgeous to look at. You know, there's a great scene with the black and white tree that catches on fire in a burst of, you know, orange flames in this black and white scene. So I think this is something we start seeing more of because computers make it easier. You think of one of my favorite movies of 2005 was Sin City, which brilliantly plays around with color in black and white scenes, sort of the way that the comic books used spot color in black and white to highlight specific blood or a character's eyes or a red dress on a hot dame. That kind of thing is, I think, really, really interesting. So we see these filmmakers using digital technology to play around with color, and it's not just inserting color into black and white scenes. The Coen brothers have been very interesting in the way that they've used digital technology. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It has that really cool look to it. It's sort of takes place in, you know, the South during the Depression, sort of really dusty, oversaturated look. Everything looks a little overexposed. It's not all the harsh sort of overexposure that you see in, I don't know, a Soderbergh movie like the Mexico scenes in Traffic. It's more this sort of glowy, nice golden brown. And that was a lot of that was done digitally. Obviously, Roger Deakins, their cinematographer, did a great job of filming it. But they were able to that was one of the first movies they completely color corrected digitally. They filmed it all. They scanned all the film into a computer and then used computers to correct all the colors. And they would do something very interesting similarly to this with The Man Who Wasn't There, which is black and white but was filmed in color and then digitally converted to black and white. And the reason they might do that rather than just filming with black and white film is that when you have the colors and you bring them into the computer, you can very carefully control shades of gray digitally. And, you know, if you've seen The Man Who Wasn't There, it's just gorgeous the way that the contrasts look. And some other filmmakers do some similar things. Jeunet, making the French film Amelie, many of the gorgeous colors that you'd never be able to see just with film alone are, I mean, it looks like a Technicolor movie almost. That's very heavily been digitized to bring out those colors. And so I think definitely the digital toolbox has really expanded filmmakers' ability to play around with color in black and white.
And I think it's nice that audiences are starting to accept this again. You meet a lot of people who say, well, I don't like black and white. And I don't know if they're really saying that they don't like black and white or just prefer more contemporary films with more contemporary attitudes. I don't know. But with the recurrence of a lot of filmmakers playing with black and white and playing with color, doing interesting things with both that haven't really been done in the last 100 years, you see a lot more acceptance of different visual styles. That's kind of interesting.
Well, I think definitely sort of the art house scene that has sprung up since the 90s. Helps along with that. You can get filmmakers like the Coens who straddle the line between independent filmmakers and who also have a lot of popular hits. You know, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is a very popular movie. The Big Lebowski is super popular, that they can kind of play around with stuff like The Man Who Wasn't There. And studios can see that black and white isn't necessarily the kiss of death. Of course, something we're going to mention more in our next segment, in the next episode, we're going to talk about, well, what is it about black and white that makes it so compelling to filmmakers and to audiences. So check us out next week for that.
So our next segment is called Good Bad Movie. Now, you may be a fan of bad movies already, or you may just have no idea why you'd ever choose to watch a movie you knew to be bad. So if you're in the latter category, let's talk a bit about why you might choose to watch a bad movie. And the reason is pretty much because they're really entertaining sometimes when they try to be good and fail miserably. It's kind of a sadistic kind of humor, I suppose, Stephen. What is it about bad movies that are so appealing sometimes?
It's hard to describe. Part of it, I think, is that it's, yeah, it is a sadistic, sarcastic humor, but it also works well in groups. You've got a couple people around, and no one's going to want to watch a movie seriously. You can watch a bad movie and just make fun of it, Mystery Science Theater style, and that is really entertaining.
Yeah, Mystery Science Theater is interesting because it's a show that's basically all about heckling bad movies. And why did this catch on? It's such a strange idea. Let's have a comedy show that lasts 2 hours and is all about a bad movie. And yet it was quite a hit, at least with certain people.
Yeah, and I think it just tapped into something that people have been doing for a long time, since probably at least the days of the drive-in.
Yeah. So we're going to feature a particular bad movie. It's my favorite bad movie of all time.
Yeah, mine too.
And yours too. It's called Sinbad of the Seven Seas, and it was released in 1989. It stars Lou Ferrigno playing the role of Sinbad. And as the opening credits inform us, this is based on a story by Edgar Allan Poe called The Thousand and Second Tale of Scheherazade. It's not. I mean, he did write a story along those lines, but it has absolutely nothing to do with what follows. I guess they put in this little blurb in the beginning to lend this some credibility or something?
I don't know, but it does serve as a signpost that nothing in this movie is going to have much rhyme or reason to it.
So, as the movie opens, we get an echo of The Princess Bride, which was made just a couple of years before. Basically, a mother comes in to tell a bedtime story to her daughter. And, I gotta tell you, they would make the worst public speakers of all time, these two people. It's like, does it have a princess? Of course. What kind of a story would it be without a princess? She was a wonderful princess. Oh my goodness.
I don't know what's going on in that scene. I get the feeling that it was dubbed in later by some sound guys.
Well, that movie was filmed in 1986, a few years earlier, and what happened was the studio, Cannon Films, went bankrupt, and so the movie was shelved, it was unfinished, and just sat around. And 2 or 3 years later, Cannon Films went under new ownership, and they said, oh, well, we got this movie here. So they gave it to this guy, Luigi Cozzi, I guess you say, and they said, well, hey, finish it up. And he said, all right, well, there's not a lot of narrative sense here. I know. We'll have it be a bedtime story, and that gave the excuse to have some narration throughout the movie to kind of stitch together the pieces that didn't quite fit. So, well, the stitches didn't fit either, but it was at least a valiant attempt. So, as the story goes, there's the sailor Sinbad.
And we should actually mention that this is not in any way related to those Harryhausen versions of Sinbad.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
This has nothing to do with those.
Nothing. And he has a bunch of people on his ship, and I guess they just, you know, they're friends or something. There's a Chinese soldier of fortune who, I guess has a name, but it's not used very much. He's just referred to simply as the Chinese soldier of fortune. And similarly, the bald cook, which you'd be loved to be known as the bald cook. There's a dwarf character on board who does have a name. His name is Poochie. And that's not condescending at all. And what else do we have? We have a Viking.
Who's
and,
just the Viking warrior.
The Viking warrior.
The Prince Ali.
And the Prince Ali, who's actually, I mentioned before that the mother and daughter scenes were filmed later to make sense of the footage that already existed. they didn't make much sense of it originally either. I guess originally the mother was saying something about how Prince Ali and Princess Alina were brother and sister. And of course, by the end, they're married. They're supposed to be in love with each other all through. And I guess the mother also said something about how Alina was in love with Sinbad. So I guess the person who was hired to stitch together the movie didn't really have any better idea of what was there either.
Well, I think probably they were just improvising those lines as they went along.
Could be.
And so they hadn't actually watched the entire movie yet, didn't know how it came out, were just guessing in the opening scenes.
Complicating matters was the fact that some of the original dialogue from when the movie was shelved was lost. That's why there's some scenes where the characters are talking, but you can't hear them. There's just the mother's narration over that. The studio actually hired lip readers to try to figure out what was being said because they couldn't use the script. They didn't follow the script. But the thing is, the actors were speaking so many different languages on the set, I guess they dub it in later, that the lip readers couldn't figure out what was being said. And so they just made up some narration that would kind of stitch it together. The footnote to that story is the original director did not even know the movie was completed until he saw it on the shelf in the video store.
I wonder if he rented it and watched it or just didn't bother. Do you think he was sitting around watching it going, what did they do to my masterpiece? was he like Orson Welles when he saw the release version of The Magnificent Ambersons?
I don't know. Maybe.
I got a feeling he never watched it. Why would you bother if you had directed it?
Well, what happens is these people come into port and there's nobody there. There's nobody there.
There's nobody there.
I just said that, Stephen. That's the point. Now, the reason there's nobody there is because the evil wizard Jafar, who lives in a gyroscope on a volcano in a tower room of a fortress, I think, and he's cast an evil spell over everybody that made them knock over their own vending carts and stuff and run away. I'm not really sure.
Jafar's evilness is more hinted at than really shown.
Yeah, well, no, he is evil because he waves his hands like nobody.
And the narration consistently informs us that he is the most evil vizier of all evilness that was ever evil, and he serves all evil.
Okay, that's a good point. Nobody is ever referred to simply by their name. In fact, sometimes the name isn't even necessary. There are always some elaborate description of who the person is all over again. So every time somebody says Jafar, they don't just say Jafar. They say the most evil wizard of all, or the hideous evil Jafar, because we might have forgotten who he was, you know, of course. Jafar is referred to as those two things, also as the satanic sorcerer of Basra, and my favorite, the wicked Jafar, wizard of all that is evil. And the character who says that follows that up by saying, you know him, don't you?
Of course, we all know him. I know him well.
Princess Alina, at various times, is referred to as the princess of all that is good, and the loveliest and sweetest princess that ever lived.
That's pretty lovely.
Talk about damning with faint praise.
And of course, they're still just stealing it from the Princess Bride.
Yeah. Then Sinbad is the greatest prince of the seas, the conqueror of the seven oceans, the greatest sailor of all the seas, and the man I hate more than hate itself, which doesn't really hold up to a lot of thought.
Well, he hates hate. I mean,
he hates hate.
Hates it a lot.
And then some other proper nouns, the hands of goodness, the cavern of nothingness, the winds of utter destruction, which, by the way, don't even ruffle anybody's hair, the loyal little dwarf, because that's not condescending either.
Well, it's really pretty much just like bad fan fiction.
Pretty much. Was that redundant, Stephen?
Oh, yeah, I think it might have been.
And the other thing that I just want to mention about the language of this film is the Chinese soldier of fortune is fond of quoting Confucius, although I'm pretty sure Confucius never said anything like this. I think his name is Cantu, but it really should be Alfalfa.
He's got an alfalfa hairstyle.
Sticking way up there. But anyway, he says at two points in the movie, one, he says, luck is like a crystal glass. Though it sparkles, it's fragile. Words to live by.
Very wise.
Number two, when the world is upside down, chin up.
That makes no sense.
So what is it about this movie that's so good? I mean, it's just relentlessly bad. We could spend the whole show, I'm sure, talking about different scenes in this that are entertaining.
Well, I think there's a couple of things at play. One is that there's these weird constant motifs. Sinbad, every time he draws his sword, immediately throws it away. And we're never clear why this...
Right, he's confronting a bad guy, so he...
draws his sword.
Threateningly draws his sword.
And throws it away so that he can go punch him.
At one point, he throws away his scabbard.
Yeah, it makes no sense at all. There's those little moments, and then just this grander scheme. The movie is just incompetently made, incompetently told. The acting is atrocious, and... oh. But it managed to be so bad at every moment, you think it couldn't get much worse. And then, hey, sock puppet piranhas! Or, hey, let's rewind some footage and then show it again in slow motion.
Slow motion is used a lot in this. I don't know if it was to pad out the running time or to make really boring fights seem exciting. the best fight scene in terms of how horribly unexciting it is the fight with the Ghost King on the Isle of the Dead. And Sinbad goes in to confront the Ghost King. And the Ghost King raises his sword a couple of inches, and Sinbad grabs it by the blade and takes it out of his hand and chops his head off. It's over in 2 seconds, even in slow motion. It's horrible.
But this entire sequence for the fighting the ghost armies takes roughly 3 or 4 years. I usually just pass out sometime during the sequence and wake up later in the movie. There's other interesting things, too. What little plot that it has, it randomly, constantly abandons. There's a part where Sinbad goes and talks to this oracle to find out where these magical gems are, and then immediately forgets everything the oracle told him, and they start debating where to go next, despite the fact that the oracle just told them where to go next, and hey, they're already where they should be.
Yeah, there is that great line of dialogue as they're deciding where to go next. Well, we could go to that island over there that the oracle told us to go to. Hey, that's a neat idea. The reason they were debating in the first place is to see where they could find the Princess Alina, where she was. Well, they already knew she was back at Jafar's palace.
Yeah, and
it wasn't a secret.
There's a scene early on when Sinbad and his crew arrive into Basra and find it completely empty, and so Sinbad's going to go to that palace to investigate, and he sends his crew out to go investigate as well. And when it cuts back to the crew, they're eating at a restaurant, but apparently there are no people in the city is the whole point. So, one, why aren't they investigating? And two, where did they get the food? I can only assume that they were walking by, saw that everyone had left, there's a restaurant full of food, and hey, we're hungry, let's go. Or that same scene, you know, Jafar sends the evil guards out, and Sinbad's crew beats them all up.
I don't think they land a punch, a single punch.
Yeah, Sinbad's crew just destroys these guards, and the next scene, Sinbad's crew is in the dungeon. Did they surrender after they had won? Did they go turn themselves in?
I think they did the honorable thing. So this other wonderful scene, and it's toward the beginning when Sinbad is just coming to town and he's going to confront Jafar, find out what's going on. So Jafar uses that old dastardly trick where he pulls a switch and a trapdoor opens underneath Sinbad and he falls into the dungeons. So how is he going to get out? Well, it turns out that there are some snakes down there. And the beginning is a little dry. This is the point, I think, where the movie suddenly becomes really, really entertaining. Because Sinbad just looks over the snakes and starts talking to them like he's their therapist or something, saying, I know how you feel. People are always mistreating you. And he goes on and on. And he says things like, well, I wouldn't hurt you. I'm better. And so what does he do? He ties them in knots and makes a rope out of them and climbs out that way. Who puts this in a movie? I mean, if they were playing it straight, which I think they were, who came up with that idea?
My favorite part, of course, is Sinbad claims he's not going to hurt them and then climbs on them. And we're talking about Lou Ferrigno, the Incredible Hulk, is climbing on a chain made of snakes. Snakes on a chain, if you will. But certainly the opposite of not hurting them. So Sinbad's also a liar. And of course, the entire movie seems to be taking itself more or less seriously. There's one or two lines that seem as though they might intentionally be jokes.
Have you taken your medication?
Right, but for the most...
That's one.
For the most part, the movie seems to be serious. It's like it's trying to be a good fantasy film.
And that's why it's entertaining, really.
Yeah.
Because it fails so totally.
And you know, I remember when you first saw this movie, Sam, and you were telling me about it, and I'm like, well, I've seen a lot of bad movies. It's not going to be that great. Come on, I've been watching Mystery Science Theater for a decade. Sam talked it up to me for, I think, 2 years before I finally saw it. By the time I finally saw it, I'm like, this is not going to be what I'm expecting. And I was right. It was so much better. This is probably the best bad movie out there. If there's a better one, I'd like to see it. But I've seen a lot of Mystery Science Theater. I've watched a lot of bad movies, and this one really takes the prize.
I think what makes it is the character of Jafar, because he's just so far over the top in the acting. It's showcased best, I think, in a scene toward the end when Sinbad walks into his palace and says, you know, I think we should fight man-to-man. And he says man-to-man in very even, well-modulated tones. And Jafar comes back and says, man-to-man! And his hands are gyrating above his head. He just can't say a simple line. He has to act it out and overact it. Most of the best lines are his. And I don't even want to try to recreate most of them. There's the famous ha scene. I tried. I can't say ha like Jafar can. I haven't heard anybody. It'll send you into fits. You'll have to stop the tape.
And his voice gets so high that if you play it loud enough, it will actually shatter all the glass in the room. It's amazing.
Great makeup and fingernails and costumes on him, too. It's just very exaggerated. You've never seen a bad guy like this.
Yeah, and so if you haven't seen Sinbad of the Seven Seas, and why the heck would you have... Definitely go rent it. It's on DVD, which is wonderful. I don't know why. I guess it's for people like us. Get it and try and watch it with a group. It'll be funny if you watch it by yourself, but much, much funnier with 3 or 4 other people at least with you.
Next up is a segment called Film Style Spotlight. And today's subject is Italian neorealism. Now, that's a mouthful.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It sounds like exciting. If you don't know what that is, it probably sounds far too stuffy and academic to make good entertainment, and you're probably already turning this podcast off and fast-forwarding or whatever, but don't do it. Actually, the Italian neorealist movement produced a lot of entertaining movies. Maybe not for everybody, but probably if you like, for example, John Steinbeck, you know, the Grapes of Wrath and Of Mice and Men, those sorts of stories, there's a great chance you'll like the movies of the Italian neorealists. So let me start by demystifying the term a little bit and give you a sense of its place in history. It was inspired mostly by an Italian movement in the 30s to introduce realism into art, and also by a movement in France at the time called Poetic Realism, which was kind of realism with dramatic highlights, I guess is a layman's explanation of that. And it was headed by such directors as Jean Renoir. Now, there's a full circle here because Italian neorealism in turn influenced the French New Wave, starting in 1959. And also, to mention a few other things, the spaghetti westerns made in the 60s, and actually the Dogma 95 movement, which came out of Denmark in 1995, is actually an insidiously insane extreme version of Italian neorealism, you could sort of call that. Anyway, neorealism also used by later Italian directors like Federico Fellini and Michelangelo Antonioni as a jumping-off point for developing their own styles, ultimately.
What I think is interesting is, of course, Fellini starts off making realistic movies,
yeah,
and then just goes completely insane and creates, you know, some great works of surrealism.
A total 180. The transition is interesting to see because it's very contradictory, the beginning and the ends of his career. I mention all this influence now to emphasize just how important this movement was in terms of film history, but it only lasted for about 7 or 8 years, and there were only 3 major directors involved. The first true neorealist film is probably Rome Open City, made in 1945 by Roberto Rossellini. Actually, there's another candidate for the first neorealist film from 1943, which was made by Luchino Visconti. It was an adaptation of The Postman Always Rings Twice before any American version was made. The third major neorealist director of the time was Vittorio De Sica, who probably made the most famous one, The Bicycle Thief, also known as Bicycle Thieves in England.
That's an important distinction.
It is an important distinction, because it's not like Alien and Aliens. Those were different movies.
Right.
So there's only one. And the last film was Umberto D, which was made by De Sica in 1952. So a very short period of time and a very small number of people, and yet they had this film movement that was very influential. So the guiding principles of this movement were these. Shoot on location, use non-actors for all the minor characters, and maybe even for the major characters, and most importantly, the stories you tell would be about the working class, struggling with poverty usually, trying to recover their lives after a very war-torn situation in Italy. Stories of everyday life, as it is, or was anyway. The location shooting really helps create the atmosphere, too, because you got all these shots of bombed-out buildings and villages that have just been crushed and now are starting to reemerge and kind of revive themselves. And that really helps you get a sense of the people trying to just keep their lives going in the face of adversity. You don't get that from the studio lot types of shots and scenes.
Of course, that adversity that you're seeing is part of the reason neorealism developed in Italy, because there wasn't it was no longer an Italian film industry. Italy was not, I mean, they didn't come out of that war with a successful, flourishing economy. It was really, really damaged, really destroyed.
Right. So they needed their narrative art to speak to those times. And
well, not only that, but they didn't have a ton of money to go film on expensive sets and hire actors.
Yeah. I just want to talk a bit about a couple of the films. Steven, what's your favorite neorealist film? Maybe you could talk about that.
I think, yeah, my favorite film is probably Open City, just because I really like the story. I think it's cool. I mean, here you have a movie about World War II that's filmed just as World War II has ended. It was made in 45 and takes place in 44, you know. And I think it's a sort of story that we don't necessarily see a lot of in America, the idea that there was an Italian resistance and that the Nazis were working against it in Italy. It's an interesting, unique story told in a really creative way, because it seems so authentic. It feels like a documentary at times.
Absolutely, yeah. So you mentioned The Bicycle Thief, too. I'll just say a few words about that. That is a much more personal story about a guy who relies on his bicycle to work. And when that's stolen, he's pretty much left stranded without any means to support himself. And so it's a pretty heartbreaking story. There are echoes of it in the works of John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath, for example, where you have a very personal story, but that's really about a broader problem, a national situation.
One thing, I'd like to mention is I avoided seeing The Bicycle Thief for a really long time because I was convinced it was going to be this pretentious, arty, boring movie, because it's one of those movies that get kind of like held up as this is a foreign movie, and you see it a lot referenced in other movies, and I just thought I was going to hate it, and I loved it when I finally got around to seeing it. I wish I had watched it earlier, and I think if you're hesitant about seeing these sorts of movies, it's very, like you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, Sam, it's very engaging. You know, I'm not going to say it's not a fun movie, it's pretty heartbreaking, but it's definitely a good, interesting, engaging movie.
Yeah, it's not all academic.
No, it's not.
It's not all a head movie. It does really hit your emotions hard, and that, I think that's not expected when you say a term that's so stodgy as Italian neorealism.
In fact, yeah, all these movies are very much about well-drawn characters going through problems you can relate to. In a way, it's more engaging than a lot of Hollywood big-budget films, because this is something that you can probably relate to. I don't really have a whole lot of empathy with Arnold Schwarzenegger's plight fighting a predator. That's not something I've ever experienced. But, you know, the idea of loss of work, anyone who's been unemployed knows that sort of heartbreak, and here it is on a much grander scale.
Yeah, even if the scale is different, there's the seed there that you can relate to. My favorite Italian neorealist film is La Terra Trema. In English, the title means The Earth Trembles. It was made by Visconti in 1948, and a similar situation to The Bicycle Thief. It's about a family, in this case, a very large family, in a fishing village in Sicily, and this village has just been really hit economically. So there are a number of different story threads going on, mostly having to do with how this family is going to stay afloat financially, and there's also some personal threads going through all this. You know, the problem begins when their fishing boat is destroyed, and so they don't have a means to go out and get fish and bring it to the docks and sell it. But you get a real sense that this is everybody's story, really. To some, maybe the details are different, but everybody in this village is all kind of in the same boat. And the movie is great at balancing the stories of these specific individuals with the overall story of this village. In particular, there are some scenes that take place on the docks where the fish are brought in and are traded, they're bought and sold and everything, and the people are just mobbed onto these docks, and they just have to make some really tough deals. I mean, they can't be sold for enough money, but it's still too expensive for people to buy. It's a real compelling sense of desperation almost there, but people are coping. People are getting through this. They're facing the adversity and somehow figuring out a way to get through. And so that was very moving to me. And I also thought the film was very observant about how people behave in those sorts of situations.
Well, definitely. And these movies are not at all nihilistic. They're not, things are bad.
It sounds that way when you describe it, but they're not. No.
There's a definite sense that, you know, though there are bad things, people ultimately are good and can overcome these bad things. So we mentioned earlier Federico Fellini, one of the most famous Italian directors and generally considered to be one of the greatest directors. I think if you asked critics to list their top 10 greatest, Fellini would probably be in the top 10 for sure. And he has an interesting history. He started out as a writer in these movies in the early 40s. And he wrote on some movies that we've mentioned, such as he worked on the screenplay for Open City. And in the early 50s, he started actually directing his own films. And some of the famous ones from that early period, you can think of La Strada, which means the road, and is about sort of carnival-type performers. Or he did a movie about a prostitute, Knights of Cabiria, in 57. And these movies are interesting because they're sort of a bridge between neorealism and the New Wave, which kind of will influence all European movies in the early 60s. Fellini starts off, obviously, working in that realistic mode, and his early movies are realistic, but not quite. There's a real sense of surrealism, I think, you know, even to something like La Strada, which is 1954, wouldn't you say, Sam?
Yeah.
And so I think it's very interesting. If you watch Fellini, he's a little bit later, I don't know, we'd classify his movies as a director as being neorealist, but certainly he was influenced by it. He shot on locations, he used a lot of real people instead of actors in the background, that kind of thing, but wasn't interested in telling those same sort of stories. So it's an interesting transition.
Yeah, La Strada does come off like a neorealist film, but if you kind of listen to it and get not just its musical rhythms, but also the rhythms of the characters, something seems a little fantastic about them. And so it's just not, It doesn't really feel quite like the experiences of everyday people, but that's sort of the stories being told. So the message from this segment is don't be scared of that term and maybe seek some of these out. It's the end of the show. That means it's time to give you the answer to the trivia question mentioned earlier in the show. Do you remember what that was, Stephen?
Was it which movie starred Michelle Pfeiffer and Jack Nicholson as a werewolf?
No. Boris Karloff and Jack Nicholson.
Well, similar.
And they're in the same movie. There's two answers. Both films were directed by the legendary schlock producer Roger Corman.
Oh, that's a shock.
Yeah, in 1963. First one is The Raven, which also had Vincent Price and Peter Lorre in it, one of many Poe adaptations that he made. And what happened was, once The Raven wrapped, Corman realized, well, we got this great set and a few days left on Karloff's contract. Let's do another movie. So he went home, wrote a script, and came back, and they started shooting it. And it took him 4 days. And they had five directors over the course of those 4 days. One of them was Nicholson himself. Another one was actually a very young Francis Ford Coppola. The name of the movie was called The Terror.
The Terror.
The Terror. And it was pretty terrible.
Yeah, so was that pun. We appreciate a lot of the feedback we got from our first episode. Glad you guys liked it. It's been a lot of work. We've been planning it for quite a while, but it was nice to hear all the good comments. And we got a couple questions that we want to go ahead and address. One from loyal listener Eric. I assume he's going to be loyal, but he was certainly listening to the first episode, and I actually happen to know him and where he lives, so if he doesn't remain loyal, I will go and beat his loyalty out of him. Anyway, he says, "Well, that is a fine show you have there. How did you guys make this?" Well, Eric, glad you asked. The answer is pretty simple. We just use software that lets us talk over the internet. It's called Voice Over Internet Protocol software, over VoIP. So Sam and I talk to each other because, in case you didn't know, we live on opposite coasts of the U.S. And then we each separately record the audio input from our mics. So while I'm talking, I am recording on my computer what I'm saying, but it doesn't pick up what Sam's saying. He's recording that on his end. And then we go ahead and upload the files to a central server, and then we download them and just splice them together using an editing program called Audacity, which is freely available. And then basically we go ahead and have the two audio tracks, edit them a little bit, and put them together and make an episode.
Yeah, but change edit a little bit to edit a lot.
Shh, that's our secret.
Oh, right.
These are actually recorded live. We actually have all that. No prep work or anything. We know all of this off the top of our heads.
Well, I have another question from somebody whose handle is Talking Dog. And he asks if animation will be covered by the show. Absolutely. Until you mentioned it, though, I hadn't realized we hadn't done a whole lot of coverage of animated features in the episodes we've recorded so far. We've actually recorded 8 or 9 episodes in advance, actually.
What? No, we haven't. These are all live.
Except for the fact that they're live.
That's right.
Somehow both of those things are simultaneously true. But we'll definitely be covering animation, both peripherally and in dedicated segments in future episodes. That's our show for this week, but stop by our website, allmovietalk.com. There's a blog there and constant conversation, so you can tide yourself over until we can come back with another episode next Tuesday. Stephen, what are we going to be talking about next week?
We have some interesting stuff. The ultimate James Bond nerd, I think that's you, are going to be talking about the James Bond series. I'm going to explain how I feel, really, about the Spider-Man movies, and I think we're going to talk a little bit more about color.
That sounds exciting. Another place you can go to while you're waiting for that episode is rinkworks.com. It's rinkworks.com. And there's a bunch of movie-related things there, as well as some other entertainment features. So, until next week.